Hello, my name is Brian Novoselsky, and I'm an associate editor with Drug Topics. Today, I'm joined by Diana Isaacs, Director of Education and Training in Diabetes Technology at the Cleveland Clinic. This week's episode will be focusing on glucagon-like peptide 1 medications, or as most people know them, GLP-1s. Diana is here to discuss what pharmacists need to know about counseling patients on GLP-1 prescription drugs. What are some of the common trends you've seen within the GLP-1 space, and how have these trends been observed among patients?
Well, the GLP-1s have been a very interesting medication class. So I still remember back in 2005 when the first one was approved, exenatide immediate release. I guess I'm really dating myself now, but Byetta. So, right, that was a twice daily, had to be taken within 1 to 60 minutes before meals. And so at the time, that was just for type 2 diabetes. And then it's been so exciting to see it evolve, where we then got the extended release exenatide by Durion, and then liraglutide. Finally, we got a daily one that really showed the cardiovascular benefits. And through all of these years, now it's been, gosh, it's been 20 years, right? We've seen how this medication class now has all of these other indications. So for example, to treat overweight and obesity, for the cardiovascular outcomes in people with type 2 diabetes, and even in people with obesity with semaglutide. And then we've also seen new exciting indications like for sleep apnea. We've seen benefits in heart failure and in fatty liver. And so all that to say, it's not surprising that the use of these drugs is growing. It's growing a lot, to the point where we've had multiple shortages and access has been an issue, although that thankfully is now resolved, or at least the companies are saying it's resolved. So that's really good. I think that, you know, when anything new comes out at first, there are some people that really jump on board and want to try it, and then others who have some hesitancy. So you hear sometimes people are very worried about the safety and the side effects. But the reality is we have 20 years now of use and of data. And so we are seeing an increase in use. And now our guidelines, especially for type 2 diabetes, this drug class is listed as a first-line medication when it comes to people that have cardiovascular disease or are high risk, for people now that have kidney disease, because now semaglutide showed benefits and it actually got the indication for kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. And then when it comes to people that may need weight loss, which is 90% of people with type 2 diabetes, or really need a potent agent that will decrease their glucose levels, this is also considered a first line. So it's grown exponentially in diabetes. And then when it comes to obesity management, these agents are more powerful, and I would argue that they're safer than anything that we've had before. And so it's not surprising, with 70% of people that have overweight or obesity and 40% that have obesity, that we are seeing these agents continue to increase in use.
Awesome. Yeah, we definitely see it kind of everywhere in these past couple of years, just the GLP-1s booming. I think that sets the stage. We see how it is kind of industry-wide and overarching in the public, but we're here today kind of get in on how patients are seeing them. So how do you really approach counseling a patient who is just starting a GLP-1 medication for the first time?
Yeah, so when counseling someone, I mean, even first before they start, I'm going to ask them about if they have a personal or family history of thyroid cancer, because there is that black box warning about medullary thyroid carcinoma. And that really, that comes because in rodents, this was observed, but rodents have GLP-1 receptors in their thyroid. Humans really don't. So the human significance is not known, but it's a highly genetic form of cancer, and we don't want to take any risks. So I'm asking about that. The guidelines don't recommend that someone needs like calcitonin check. Like, we don't need to go above and beyond to try to see if they could have thyroid cancer, as long as they're not complaining of any nodules or anything like that. The other thing I ask about is just if they have a history of pancreatitis, because there have been increased case reports of pancreatitis. Again, it's not clear if it's directly related, because of the fact that people, these have been used in people with diabetes, and people with diabetes have increased risk of pancreatitis. So I'm asking about that background information to confirm that they don't have those. And then when starting the agent, it's really important to start with the lowest dose, and all of them, whichever one you're using, has a certain dose titration schedule, with the exception of the exenatide extended release, which just has one dose. So we're going to start at that lowest dose. And for the weekly, it's typically starting at that dose for 4 weeks and then going up to the next dose. And so, and I also counsel that we don't have to rush to the next dose, just because that is, you know, technically, usually it's the second dose that is considered the quote unquote therapeutic dose. My patients often do, they have a great response even from that lowest dose. So if they are having any of the potential side effects, then I say it's okay, we can go slower. So then I of course counsel on what those potential side effects are. And the most common are going to be those gastrointestinal. So nausea, and if nausea gets bad enough, then there's going to be vomiting. With in addition to that, diarrhea is very common, but also constipation as well. So that can go either way. Some people will have dyspepsia as well, so, or just some stomach pain as well. So those are kind of the common ones. But fortunately, there's some really good strategies to help mitigate those side effects. So one is that trying to eat less food, not eat too much food at one time, that really goes a long way. And so if they're getting a big meal, they're going out to a restaurant, maybe automatically taking half of that to go and just eating half of it. Also trying to limit the number of really high fat foods or very spicy foods. Those tend to make the GI symptoms a little bit worse. And then for the constipation, really important to drink plenty of water, also having, you know, high fiber foods. Some people experience such appetite suppression that they don't eat and then they also don't drink. And then that can really lead to constipation. So we definitely want to encourage that. And then for diarrhea, high fiber foods also can really help that as well. So that's important as well. And also trying to avoid other foods that could make it worse. So, like for example, having too much coffee or having sugar alcohols, those can make diarrhea a little worse.
Awesome. Yeah. So definitely a lot of things to kind of keep an eye on before really tapping into the benefits of GLP-1. So moving on to challenges. So you obviously touched on some of the side effects and some of the challenges that patients may face, but can you go a little deeper into the challenges that they face when they start these new medications?
Yeah, so I mean, there can be a number of them. Many people do really, really, really well. I would say the GI symptoms for some people are really problematic, and we have to go slower with the titration of the agents. That becomes really, really important. I think the other thing is that some people have so much weight loss, which sounds like a really great thing, but we have to be careful about that and how rapid the weight loss is, and also what kind of weight is being lost. I think if you ask someone what kind of weight do they want to lose, they would like to lose their fat and keep their muscle, which burns off calories and has so many benefits. Unfortunately, when you lose weight, you don't just lose fat, you also lose muscle. And studies show that people lose with weight loss, including with the GLP-1s, they lose about 30% of muscle mass. So, in order to preserve that and try to avoid this muscle wasting, taking in enough protein is really important. The recommendations are about 0.8 units per kilo per day. And also doing strength training is really important, lifting some type of weights, doing weight-bearing exercises as able to, becomes really important. The other thing, though, is that what we know when people lose weight and then gain the weight back, studies show that unfortunately, it's not that they usually gain back the same proportion of fat and protein or fat and muscle. They tend to gain back more fat and less muscle. So that's really not good. I mean, it would actually be better if someone's going to end up gaining the weight back, it would actually be better to not have lost it, because then if they stayed the same weight, they would at least have more muscle mass, right? So we need to do whatever we can to try to preserve that weight loss, because ultimately there's a lot of health benefits from this weight loss. So that's where the access to the drug becomes really important. And if someone just starts the drug but wants to stop it, but doesn't have a strategy for stopping it, or just loses insurance coverage for it, doesn't have it anymore, they're really at risk of gaining weight back. And if they're using it for diabetes, they're also at risk of having more hyperglycemia. So having some type of strategy, and I'm not saying that you necessarily have to be on the drug if you're using it for weight loss for life. That is a common question that comes up. I would say we don't fully know at this point. It is meant, they're meant to be chronic medications. And there are studies that show when groups of people were taken off of them that many of them did gain weight. But there's a lot of research looking into what types of things maybe could be done. Can we decrease the dose? Can we increase exercise? Make other healthy behavior changes that can help keep that weight loss? So, all that to say, the lifestyle changes are still so important. Getting enough exercise, for most adults recommended 150 minutes per week, which I can tell you, at least the patients I see, most people are not getting that. And then other healthy behaviors with healthy eating. These drugs, what a lot of people say is they help with the food noise. So it's actually easier to make healthy choices. People aren't like looking for all the sweet, sugary foods. And so use that to your advantage and really try to learn healthy eating, making well-balanced meals. And then those behaviors can carry with the person, regardless what happens with future use of the drug.
Awesome. Yeah, these are really great insights, and especially for weight loss specifically, I think we could sit here and kind of talk about all day about kind of how they're being used and how we're seeing them in the public. But I kind of want to expand that a little bit and talk about all indications. So with all the GLP-1 indications becoming available, are patients favoring these medications to facilitate weight loss, or are GLP-1s being used kind of equally across multiple indications?
Well, I do a ton of diabetes management, so I'm probably biased in that I see them used so much for type 2 diabetes. But the reality is that tons of people, 14% of adults now in the US have type 2 diabetes, another 36% have prediabetes. So you're talking basically half of US adults have some type of dysglycemia. So, and it's obviously it's going to help most help for both. And then of those with type 2 diabetes, 90% have overweight obesity. So they're really very much going hand in hand. I would say that there's a lot of interest in using it for obesity because the health benefits of losing weight, and also people they want to look good, they want to feel good. So we're seeing a huge uptick for people using it for weight management. I think the challenge though is the coverage has just been really mixed for weight management. So for type 2 diabetes, because it's so ingrained in the guidelines and it has for several years now, the coverage for it is much easier to get. And that's great because it goes hand in hand. It will help with someone's weight and their glucose levels. But when it comes to someone that only has obesity, then it's like kind of unfortunate because many plans won't cover it. And then they can make the choice to pay out of pocket for it. I mean, there are some copay cards that bring down the price, but still make it pretty expensive. And even like yeah, I mean, there's like the Lilly Direct. There are some programs, but you're still spending several hundreds of dollars a month, and many people don't actually have that. Now, there are some new indications, like for example, semaglutide now has the cardiovascular outcome data for obesity in people that have established cardiovascular disease. So that's the first time we've ever seen a drug for weight management show positive cardiovascular outcomes. In fact, in the past, there were several drugs that were taken off the market because they had negative cardiovascular outcomes. So that is very, very exciting. And so the coverage for people that have cardiovascular disease and obesity, they're often able now to get this drug covered. Similarly, we've seen with tirzepatide how that recently got an indication for sleep apnea in people with obesity. And that's really now increased the access for people that have sleep apnea. In fact, we've got tons of people now that are like, yes, I want to take that test. I want to see if I have it. And a lot of people with obesity do have sleep apnea. So that's great that it's shown benefit in that population. And then, of course, we've got, we don't have indications, but we've seen positive benefits in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and in kidney disease as well. So I would still say probably the two most common indications are weight management and type 2 diabetes. And I think that if there was better coverage for weight management, that would definitely be the biggest bucket of people taking it because of just how many in our country have overweight obesity. So yeah, it's continuing to just grow and grow and grow.
Sure, yeah, definitely see that. And with the new stuff, it's still continuing to grow, and you still got to keep our eyes on that. So one more question. I think this has been a great conversation. Really just want to ask you to summarize some of the positive outcomes you've seen firsthand through your counseling. So maybe some specific examples of significant patient feedback, or kind of what have you seen recently?
I've seen some incredible, incredible things. So I do a lot of my management is type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And yes, we are using these even off label in type 1, but I'm going to focus on type 2. So I have had multiple patients that have been able to come off of their insulin. I'll give you a particular example of someone with type 2 diabetes. She has had it since she was a teenager. And now she's in her early 40s. And so the natural progression when you have type 2 diabetes as a child or a teenager, usually you're started on insulin sooner and you need insulin to reach your glucose levels. So not surprisingly, she was managed on insulin, very high doses of insulin. And we had her on an insulin pump because insulin pumps can also be a great option for people with type 2 that need mealtime insulin. And I also had her on a concentrated insulin on U500 because her doses were so high that she needed a more concentrated insulin. So I was able to start her on a GLP-1 agonist. And I think actually the first one I started her on, she had some of these GI issues. Despite the counseling and everything, she had these GI issues. And what I'd encourage people listening, sometimes one causes more issues than another for a given patient. And so we stopped that one, but then we went ahead and started a different one and we slowly titrated it up. Fortunately, she did a lot better. She was able to tolerate that. And I watched how her insulin doses just came down and down and down. It was really quite incredible. Now, this particular patient is still taking insulin, but she has switched from U500 to U100. So she doesn't need these very high doses anymore. But the really remarkable thing is she's someone that really struggled to get an A1C level that was really, it was usually in the mid eights. Her time in range through using a continuous glucose monitor was often like maybe sometimes it was in the 30s, 40s, sometimes low 50s. Like that's kind of that is where she ranged. And if we could get over 50%, we were kind of like, all right, at least we did that. Now her CGM, her time in range is over, it's in the 80% consistently. And her A1Cs are now in the sixes. And she's in her low 40s. So I'm hopeful she's got many, many years ahead of her. And I want to help her avoid these potential complications that can come with diabetes, all those microvascular, like the retinopathy and the neuropathy and the kidney disease, as well as the macrovascular, the heart attacks, the strokes, cardiovascular death, heart failure. And so it's so exciting to see how this drug has benefited her so much. And it's not like she was new to me and we did this. Like I had already been working with her for years. Like we're doing everything. We're trying to incorporate all the lifestyle stuff. Like it's not like she wasn't trying, like I wasn't trying, but this drug class was like that thing to really get her into that range and have these good outcomes. And then also most importantly, she is feeling good. Like we talk a lot about these like glucose levels and weight and numbers, but how does the person feel? We want people to feel good, to be thriving, to not have to worry about their conditions and live their life. And that's what I'm seeing, that people are able to not think about all this stuff and they're able to enjoy their lives.
Awesome. I think that's the perfect way to cap this off. It's really incredible to see your work show improvements in health and these medications to allow you to do that. Also, it's great to see such a new medication in the public eye and for us to get insights from someone that's been working with it for so long. So I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.